This week on A to Z Running, we finish our examination of change in Brad Stahlberg's book by sharing practical actions, including how to practice responses and what it looks like to ask for help, among others. We also answer a couple listener questions about hard efforts on the treadmill and how to warm up well. In the world of running, the U.S. Cross Country Championships included some exciting results. And that American record we recently mentioned, well, it just went down again. Stick around to find out which. And any guesses how fast an American can run a mile at 7,000 feet of altitude? Well, you'll find out. All this and more on A to Z Running.
Welcome back to the A to Z Running Podcast, where we help runners thrive with information, inspiration, and coaching and training services. I'm Andy.
And I'm Zach. And just a reminder that you can learn about everything we do here by going to atozrunning.com and follow us on the places where we are most present. That includes Instagram, YouTube, and Spotify primarily. And as you can see here, the best of A to Z Running is not live with me right now, and so Andy is away. We'll certainly have to apologize for your lesser experience, having less of Andy and too much of Zach. But as it were, though she's away, she actually had the opportunity to still participate more actively in the content here. So we're going to be able to go back and forth, as you've already noticed, sharing some different things from both of us. And so as a result, we hope that that will tide you over better until Andy is back again with us. Speaking of things for Andy to share, she's got a thought to start us off.
As some of you can tell who are watching on YouTube or Spotify, I am coming to you off location. Zach is in studio in Michigan and I am in Washington, D.C. And I have enjoyed some beautiful snowy runs here. It's been more snow than is usually accumulated in D.C. And so it's been a really special time to be in this city. It's very beautiful with the snowfall and the monuments. It's been wonderful. Something odd, though, that happened to me when I was in D.C., all of you know, if you follow our podcast, how much I enjoy social running, even though Zach might not enjoy it as much as I do. But I wanted to run with a group, and so I saw a couple groups out and about on Sunday, and I saw a group come up, and I said hello, and nobody acknowledged me. No one said hello back. That's okay. That happens sometimes. Another group is running towards me and I'm like, oh, I'll try again. And I said hello again. No one said hello back. And I was really secretly hoping that I could like join a group of runners while running. And since I didn't get a response from either of those groups, I was like, oh, I'm probably gonna end up running by myself. Well, I saw the first group again and I have relentless optimism. So I say hello again. And I didn't get a response. I didn't get a hello or even a look or wave. So I did end up running alone. And I realized like not there are like friendly groups in DC, and I just happened to catch like maybe some weird moments. But I don't know, has anyone ever experienced that where like, you know, you're not completely dejected, but you feel like a little bit sad because you haven't been acknowledged by the other runners? Well, that's where I was at. But if you've experienced the same thing, let me know. We can commiserate.
Yeah, apparently people are not terribly polite sometimes, even runners, which I find that hard to believe. Runners are among the classiest of humans on the planet. But maybe the fault is not the runners, but the fact that they are in Washington, D.C., and that by itself has the chance to make anyone unhappy. All right, speaking of things that involve interacting with runners, we have some questions to answer, and so let's get on now to your questions.
Well, We love answering listener questions on the A to Z Running podcast, and you can do that by emailing us questions@azrunning.com. You can also send us a message anywhere that's convenient for you that we are at, such as Instagram or Spotify now has an interactive component, maybe Facebook. You can message us in those ways, just like Pete did. And he asked a question that I have been eager to get to because it is super relevant right now. There's a lot of treadmill running going on. And he asks how to modify or how to do workouts like steady states and fartleks on a treadmill. Great question, Pete. This is a question that I wanted to touch on because it's so important to discuss what is safe for a runner and what is worth it. So Zach, he said to me the other day, he's like, it's not worth it at all for you to be doing workouts on the treadmill because it's too much of a risk. So we did a little bit of compromise and I did a light steady after doing some running on the treadmill first. So my first piece of advice for anyone is that if you haven't been on a treadmill in a year or a couple months, that your first run on the treadmill should not be a super long run and it should not be a workout. You want to ease yourself into treadmill running, okay? And the reason for that is that you could get an injury. It's just enough different from outdoor running that you could end up getting injured from running on the treadmill, which is something that you wanted to avoid by not running on the ice, right? So the first run that you have on a treadmill should be easy. It should be jogging. And then from there, if you become more adapted for the treadmill, then if you have a steady state on your schedule, I would go on, there's a range, right? There's a range of effort. I would go on the lower end of that range to stay safe. I wouldn't push any limits by going too far or too fast on a treadmill. For fartleks, I rarely recommend that an athlete does a fartlek on a treadmill unless they are very well adapted for treadmill running. These people might do 3 days a week, and they have been doing that since, you know, the summertime because their kids are needing them to be on a treadmill, so it's during their naps or whatever. Those are people that maybe could do it, and they could do it safely. But even with fartleks, I don't want them to be the faster ones. I want them to be the 3 to 5 minute fartleks, not anything that's too aggressive. Because even if you think about it, just getting the speed up on the treadmill can be a very dangerous thing because it's a little bit slower than your click. So you don't know exactly how fast it's going to feel once you ramp it up really quickly. So we're doing everything easing in and easing out. So easing in the beginning of a 2 minute, you're gonna go slowly ramping it up and then slowly ramping it back down, all included in that time for your fartlek. But like I said, I rarely recommend that. Instead, what I would recommend is running easy again instead of your fartlek, or perhaps doing another light steady state run for another great productive run in your week aerobically. So those are my recommendations, but if in doubt, run easy. You've heard us say that, and now it's something that I feel like I'm going to be repeating over and over, because the reason for that is that we want to avoid injury. Consistency over time is key. So a few weeks of rows that are really bad, that you're on the treadmill a little bit more, it's okay for you to be safe instead of really pushing the limits on a new stimulus, which is the treadmill.
Thank you, Andy, for those thoughts on Pete's question. Now, I've got one here that I want to share from Craig, and it's in the same line of trying to figure out things to do with hard efforts and what does that look like. And we're always trying to puzzle out the best way to do all of these things. And so I appreciate that these questions can, in fact, connect to each other as well, relate to one another. So Craig wrote in the question specifically here is, what is the best warm-up for harder efforts? Specifically, something like fartlek or tempo runs. That's something that we recommend a fair bit of in our training schedules. And when we do, we include something like 5 to 10 minutes of jogging or easy running before you do the stuff. So then Craig says, well, that is what I have been doing. And as soon as I feel like it, could be 8 or so minutes. He said it sometimes is more, sometimes less. That's to be expected. I start going harder. And I have heard from others that to get the best training effect, I should do the easy run, but follow that with something like a short walk. And then concluding my warm-up and starting the harder effort with a little bit of a break between. So, I'd be interested to know the source of the claim in terms of the how that is a better training effect, because it could potentially be, but it depends on what you are, what you're pursuing. And so, as we would say, with all of these things, there are a few layers. One of them here is whether you're maximizing performance or whether you're maximizing certain elements of the training effect. You know, am I trying to get at more sustained musculoskeletal, more sustained energy system stuff, any of that kind of stuff? There's a number of things. But on the whole, our recommendation is that you do a continuous warm-up jog into the effort. You just increase your effort until you're at the whatever the thing is you're doing for that day. So the jogging is in essence to get things like the blood flowing, the temperature rising, your all of your energy system types of things, internal systems functioning. And it's good regardless of the temperatures and conditions outside. It's good regardless of what exactly you did prior to starting to run. But at the same token, there certainly are more and less. And so Craig even said that in his own experience, sometimes he does longer, sometimes shorter. It has to do with when you feel like you're kind of starting to move and feel good and comfortable in your running mechanic. And then when you do, there's a fair chance that you're ready at that point. And if it takes 3 minutes, if it takes 15 minutes. Now, the reason why we recommend continuously just moving right into the harder effort is because functionally, that's a better way to approach racing as well. You start easier and you move into harder efforts. There's that aspect. And so it's helpful to just simply have that be the normal way you go about things. Almost never should a runner, the moment the you go from standing or very little movement to pushing hard. You're not a sprinter, I'm assuming, if you're listening to this podcast, and chances are you're not running very many like 400 or 800 meter dashes. Those are different circumstances. Although arguably the 800 meter dash still should have a ramp up phase, but whatever the case may be, we suggest that there's a kind of ease in, even if you did a warm up jog, took a little break and then started your hard effort. I would still suggest that you ease into that hard effort, no matter what the case is, because that's going to be a more effective way to find the right degree of exertion. If you just start pouring it on, chances are you're overdoing it. Almost every time you're overdoing it. And so we like to ease in. Now, that's one aspect of it. Also, we just feel like you get more value from the warm-up if it is connected to the longer effort, like everything's just continuous and sustained. Because you're not letting your heart rate come down, you're keeping things moving more linearly. And so there's some value to that as far as the energy systems and things like that. It's not substantial, and so we're not very concerned about it. However, there's also a consideration here that warm-up jog shouldn't be the only thing you're doing to get ready for the effort. And that's where we talk about things like our pre-run precision and activation drills that we do as runners, our leg swings and other dynamic mobility types of things that we might do. So all of that. And we have a simple order of things that is one of two scenarios. If it's a training event, then we recommend doing the drills and the activation types of work first and then jog your warm up and ease into the harder effort. Just go right into it. If it's a race competition or it's a performance oriented event, then what you're doing is jogging some first to start to get the blood flowing a little bit, start to get the systems elevated some, and then do the pre-run precision drills and things like that. And then do some a little bit harder effort types of things running wise, like short stride outs or some of those types of things, or just do a little bit more jogging, a few minutes that's an increased effort, something like that. And so you kind of bookend it. And then you don't ease right into the race start line. You have to, you know, pause and hang out in the start area. And then when you start the race, you still ease up to full full effort for that race as well. And we have phases of that. We could talk about that, but that's not the question at the moment. So you can see here, we have a couple of considerations. And Craig, we appreciate the question. Ultimately, we do feel like it is just simply a better general practice to ease from your jogging right into your harder effort. But if someone were to say, I'm not going to do that, and here's my list of reasons why, and I think that that's what I need, we're probably not going to push too hard for it. So there you go. Not too challenging a perspective, because you can kind of take what you need in the moment. Thanks for asking, Craig. Thank you for the questions in general. Remember that you can send your questions every week to questions@A2Z running.com. That email goes right to us, then we can address them here on air. We'll do one or two every week, and if we can't get to yours and it's timely, then we certainly can still respond to it in email, which we do anyway as well. So there you have it. Thanks for sharing those thoughts. Now let's get on to something else helpful. If you have been listening with us since the start of the new year, then you know we are trying to address this topic of change from the perspective of it's a constant in life in general, but also when we are trying to pursue goals or pursue achievement, it necessitates some kind of change in some sense. And that change might be small, you know, just kind of a more commitment to a particular routine or something like that. But whatever the case may be, we thought that it would be valuable to dissect the topic a little bit and try to bring some practical value there. And we found a book that was helpful in providing some different ways to look at this topic. You've been hearing us talk about Brad Stolberg's book, Master of Change, which we read and have been sharing some thoughts here, and then kind of bringing into it our own thoughts and considerations, whether they align with what's in the book or in some instances, we don't necessarily fully agree with a conclusion and we share our own, and that's entirely okay. So what we've done here is we have addressed the two of the three main parts that Stolberg wanted to share in his book. And the first was mindset, and that's where we're talking about, you know, things like change is hard and we should expect it to be hard and our expectations matter immensely. That's all key. And then there's the identity piece. And so if mindset is how I perceive change, identity is how I'm thinking about myself. And in that piece, we really are considering the role of optimism, despite understanding that things are hard. And so there's a concept like tragic optimism. That's a piece of that puzzle. And then also just the considerations around who am I and how am I defining that? And the things that are more fragile and temporary or temporal and fleeting, those things should not be the anchor of my core identity because they can vanish in the blink of an eye. For instance, we feel very strongly, despite the fact that we are ourselves passionate about running as a sport, we do not feel like it is a very high priority in identity for anyone. It should not be, save in under the circumstance of like, if it's my occupation, it's higher priority than if it's my hobby. But even so, it's still fairly low on the totem pole compared to other major considerations about who am I. And all of that is to say, where we struggle sometimes in pursuing change and in executing self-discipline oftentimes has a lot to do with the discouragement that comes with I do or do not see myself, my identify with this thing, and it is or is not happening according to that expectation, that combination of the mindset identity piece. And so we run into a lot of challenges with that as runners, as humans, as all the other things. What we want to do here today now is bring these two topics into the practical application side. Stolberg used the word actions in his book, and I think that that is a fitting way to capture the thought. What can we do? So we've got these thinking aspects of change. Now, what do we do about all that? And I'm going to kind of go through a few things here and try to provide then explain some of the concepts and then provide just a few basic suggestions. Some come directly from Stolberg. Some are a combination of thoughts we have and things he wrote about and things like that. So let's talk about taking action for a moment. And there's one kind of underlying theme in Stolberg's book within this section, and that is the idea that response and reaction are not the same thing. So there's a situation, how I react to it or how I respond to it. We're going to call those two separate things. Stolberg calls it two separate things. So if that's the case, then reaction is like the lizard brain. It's the amygdala. It's the survival instinct, all that kind of stuff. Side note, I feel very strongly that our current survival instinct tends to misrepresent the degree of threat that we perceive quite easily. And there's a lot of that goes into why I feel strongly about that in concept and principle. And it's not exactly something that Stolberg addressed very thoroughly in the book himself, but it's an important consideration. So what I mean by this is, if a reaction is like the, just kind of the emotional, like how I feel immediate response, I can't use the word response though, because we're using that for the other one, an immediate reaction to whatever's happening and it's not filtered through my logical thinking brain, then, if you think about it, in almost every instance, as a survival instinct, it's not really all that needed in most day-to-day life situations. Like, we're really just not in life and death situations in any kind of serious degree most of the time for most of us. Now, if that's the case, why do we still feel really strong emotional reactions to things? And that's where I feel very... very seriously that it has everything to do with what we care deeply about. And when we perceive that thing to be under threat, then we have this kind of illogical emotional reaction. Whether it could be logical, by the way, but I'm saying that it's not thought through. It's a non-cognitive emotional reaction. So if that's the case, so we have things we care deeply about and then perceived threat, that also then is, we have to think about it in the sense of like, that can be conditioned and not even just conditioned. That is very context dependent. And so there's an example that always comes up whenever I think about these things, as one who works in the field of education, and has been a teacher in the past. So I often saw situations where a student would respond very differently than another student to like the identical situation. And the one example that always comes up, because it just seems so strange, and when you are in the midst of it, is a student will say something like, that will get very upset because another student is looking at him in some way that he doesn't like, right? So very upset because he's looking at me. And it's like, don't look at me, or, you know, keep your eyes off me, or like however the reaction is, right? And it has turned violent. In my own experience, I have observed this happen where obviously there's more involved in that moment than just someone's eyes happened to be on me and it made me violent. A history between those two students, a history related to something that, you know, perceived why the student's looking, you know, the, a kind of expression or something. But whatever the case may be, you have that. And in the same token, you can have a student not even notice that expression, that look. Someone's looking at them, doesn't, completely oblivious. So that lends itself to a consideration here that you could, in theory and in actuality, absolutely, you can condition the nature of a reaction to circumstances and situations. And we see this even more so in examples like post-traumatic stress. That is a conditioned reaction because a PTSD response to something is not conscious. It is subconscious in some sense, which means it's a reaction as opposed to a considered response. And yet it, in almost every instance, has an origin moment or some event, right? Because it's a trauma. It's a response to a trauma, a reaction to a trauma. And so we see that in these examples, we see clear proof that our reactions, whatever they may be in the moment, don't have to be that way. That isn't a guarantee when this happens, I will feel this reaction. We actually don't have to. And that's encouraging to me because as we consider pursuing anything that we care about in life, these kinds of reactions tend to be the kind of thing that cause problems for ourselves, for others, in circumstances and such. So my point here is all simply to say that's the thing we want to try to minimize, and there's a number of ways to go about it. One is pursuing how to condition myself in the sense of like how to move away from that lizard brain emotional reaction to something. And this is where Stolberg's practical suggestion comes into play. We want to focus on how we are responding instead of how we are reacting. So if the reaction is the amygdala part of the brain, that's the like the lizard brain stuff. The response stuff is I didn't even remember this until, you know, it's like taking me back to high school science until I read it in the book. But the basal ganglia, or basal ganglia, is the part of the brain that then handles like the problem solving logical thinking operations. And what seems to be the case is that those two aspects of the brain can't be functioning fully at the same time. So you're either in lizard brain mode or you're not, and you're in logical thinking mode. There's some evidence to suggest that that is kind of binary, which leads us then to the question, if that is true, then how do we make sure that it's more of the response stuff and less of the reaction stuff? Now, a couple of things here. So one is that we know in general the brain has this desire to follow familiar paths. And so if that's the case, then whatever the path that's currently like most used will, by the nature of habit, continue to use that. So the way of thinking, for instance. And in this sense, if we want to change it, we have to work fairly hard at changing the response, practicing a certain response to a certain thing. And the more we practice that, the easier it becomes. But initially, it tends to be quite challenging. I love this about that organization I've shared many times, but because their process is just one that's so simple. But the Whoop My Life organization has that built in functionally. And what they say, one of their steps is you have to, the Whoop is a four-step process, WOOP, hence the name. And the second O is this obstacle consideration. And what that means is not an obstacle externally, but an obstacle within myself. And so what am I doing or not doing that's inhibiting the desired response? And I have to be aware of that and condition it in practice before it starts to happen naturally. And that's one of the key things when they looked at the organization, when they looked at people trying to lose weight. As you might guess, this was one of the most important steps in the process. Predicting what things I do or do not do that make this difficult goal, how I respond to things or react to things that is not acceptable in a similar sense, and what would I want to do instead? And I have to be thinking about it, contemplating that, so that when the moment hits, it's an accessible option to me. It's not something I have to figure out in that moment, which is the hardest way to do it. So, okay, we've got that. Stolberg notes in the book, specifically, feelings dominate our consciousness. And this comes from, as well, another psychiatrist, I believe. But the quote here that Stolberg wrote is, just because you know something intellectually doesn't mean you'll consistently act on it, particularly in charged situations. So that's the whole piece, right? That emotion is kind of the thing that guides most of our decisions that we make, and that's not always great. So Stolberg suggests even something like, he's got four P's, in fact, for he's got a process and there's four P's. I'm not going to go through all of it with you, but pausing is one of the important steps here. When there's something happening, trying to not react right away, but just to wait a moment. And I can use that time to think, pause, so that I have a better response. But also gives me time to think about the response that I have been thinking about in the past, so I can call it to front of mind. Now, Stahlberg notes meditation as a practice that helps us in terms of like with consciousness about these kinds of things. As a practice of meditation is essentially, you know, dwelling on some thought or thoughts, some ideas or idea, and holding that in our mind. So there's much more, you know, involved there, and different people have different things to say about it. But I would assert further still that prayer specifically as a religious matter further elevates the same premise, because not only does it incorporate in principle the idea of dwelling in my thought on a particular thing, which is what prayer is in essence, thinking about something, and then I'm just simply talking to someone about it. But that someone talking to peace necessitates a degree and some extent of humility, because I am submitting to something else outside myself. That's the essence of prayer and how it differentiates from something like meditation. So that comes up here in a moment, because one of the key steps is the idea of surrender. When I'm in the midst of challenge and change and things, and what part and place does that concept have? So we'll come back to that. But I wanted to note, because it becomes an archetype here for us. I'm really fascinated by the Psalms of David, who was a king in Israel around the year 1000 BC. And very famous writings. The Book of Psalms and many others. But in particular, the Psalms of David kind of have this like process to them. And one of the things that's enjoyable about them in particular is they kind of give you this sense of like you're listening to this king process his situations out loud almost, and you, so you get some kind of sense of that, which is always interesting. And he's basically got this like this pattern. There's some kind of threat or challenge or change that's happening, and as it's happening, or whenever this has been written, then David will say something to the extent of, first he begins with like, woe is me, this terrible thing. It's almost a kind of lament. I can't believe this. And then he'll go on to say, but God, you will crush my enemies, or you are great, or usually both. You will save me, and all of that. And then also the next step is this, but your will be done. And I don't actually know exactly what you're going to do, but I'm going to praise you no matter what. And so it, like, he walks through these different kinds of thinking about a given situation, and it goes through this whole pattern. And you can see in that, this is a really important way of processing, as then we look at this concept more broadly here, where, you know, we see the challenge, we know that it's hard, whatever this moment is, we consider what we desire here. Like, I want to overcome this, I want to get past this. And then, now, as we note here in this particular example, the key component is, but I'm not in control of this. There are things here that I don't control. And so whether or not I am now looking to a higher power, looking to God in this instance, it's the same admission either way. I don't control some things here. We can all agree on that. And so now I have to submit some of that control, if not much of it or all of it. And all the better when I can submit it to a God I trust and believe in this instance. So that's the David example. And I always enjoy that, because it's literary and it has a lot of literary merit on its face. But also, it seems to be a kind of archetype for the thing that Stahlberg is expressing here in this work. So notably, Stahlberg coming back to this gives a compelling case for things that then combat our practice to try to respond better to situations. So if we've got things like meditation and prayer that are helping us respond better, what are the things that are making it harder? And he gets into social media here, and I have to say, I did not know he was going to do this. I have no awareness of Brad Stolberg's opinions on topics like social media, but it happens to be the case that Stolberg is pretty clear that social media is one of the culprits that abuses our thinking. So a couple different considerations. One is because social media has a lot to do with how fast you can get your thoughts out there. And that's one of the most important parts of when you're posting related to a topic. The faster you get the post out, the more likely you are to have interaction. And Stolberg even notes that virality in posts are based, this is measurable, they're based on two main factors. One is the speed of response, and two is the degree to which the post stokes outrage in other people. Yes, outrage is incentivized. So in fact, the quote that directly from Stolberg's book, what he says is reactivity is, in this instance, incentivized and rewarded. If I can be highly reactive, I am likely to get more of the thing I want, whatever it is, interaction, comment, who knows. Now, so that's the other side of why social media is a major challenge here, is because, and these are my words, not Stolberg's, because it's a finely curated conflagration of content that is deliberately presented to generate an unthinking emotional reaction. So incentivizing and rewarding reactivity. And it's in all the worst ways, because as you know, if you read into any of these things to any extent, you're going to find right away that it is a deliberate programming, like algorithmic programming move to optimize negative content, because negative content produces more interaction than positive content on social media. Things that make us angry and things that make us scared. Now, let's think about Strava for a moment. Yes, I'm going there. Anyone doubt that this is the case with Strava as well? I have a feeling some of you are saying, but it's not quite the same, because, you know, Strava, like, it's not news. People aren't like posting political reaction, although some people do, and then a lot of people comment on it and say, get that out of here, because Strava isn't a political space. Case in point, there are pieces here that replicate the same model. One example, and it's not the case for everybody, certainly, but one example is, whoever feels pressure to get your run posted as soon as possible, and then rename it and put in the details and stuff as soon as possible. Why? Why not wait until, you know, the next day or later on in the day? Well, because for my followers, you know, they want to see that stuff. And if I wait until the next day, no one's going to see it anymore, because the algorithm, the system, the way it works is an edited post has almost no change in whether it's going to move it to the top of someone's feed view. It's just whether it's a new post. So you get the point. There's something there. Now, I will say I do disagree with the author on one level here, because then he goes on to say, but there really is not anything inherently wrong with using social media and things like that, so long as we're intentional with how we use it. Specifically, he suggests evaluating what the medium incentivizes and how we're interacting with those incentives. Remember, we just said reactivity is incentivized and rewarded. That's true of every social media platform to date. But I would say that he is wrong on that note, because, and I'm not just saying this because I think I've got a better idea in my head than he did. But when I read, it was Jaron Lanier many years ago, wrote a book, it's like 10 reasons to delete all your social media stuff now. Jaron Lanier, who has worked for all the big tech companies, not all of them, but he's like the father of modern VR. Like, essentially he created it with another guy. And so he's been involved in these things at a very high and intimate level. And he says the problem is with this concept specifically that it is actually nearly impossible, if not literally impossible, to fully resist the behavior change efforts of these applications. And why is that? Because it's not happening consciously. Even if you're intentional and deliberate about things you're doing with this stuff, it's not something that you are consciously making choices about things. It's just being impressed upon you through the constant exposure to the stuff that is promoted and incentivized. So, and then the behavior change in terms of how I use it as well. So can you resist? Well, I would suggest even if you're resisting better, you're not resisting totally, and I don't know why we would subject ourselves to that. So, something to think about in terms of some of these things. But reaction and response is the goal here. What does it mean to be more thoughtful in our responses? And we'll come back to that here in a minute when we want to try to address the practical solutions. So one more note here about surrender. As I mentioned, we wanted to address this because Stolberg then quotes a psychiatrist, Anna Lemke, who refers to this feeling of being lost or broken, and she calls it the fundamental spiritual pivot, meaning when we feel that lost or broken sense, like I am lost, I am broken, I don't know what's going on, or feel terrible about it, all those kinds of things, that becomes the moment when we are able to change in a particular way. So Stolberg notes that this is very closely related to, if you're familiar with things like the 12-step recovery programs, and one of those principles being realize I am helpless to overcome my situation. I'm not in control. And that by itself is the key to this principle here. When I know that I am not in full control, when I realize that I'm helpless, it also creates the opportunity for me to then look for better guidance. So the psychiatrist specifically just like references the universe in general as a higher power, which is, I think, kind of strange. Universes, like places and stuff, but as it were. And Stolberg notes that, you know, certainly this is where various different religions approach this concept in various different ways. But fundamentally, we're talking about something like God. And in that instance, even if it's not, I'm submitting myself willfully, I'm pursuing a religious solution here, but I am still doing the same thing. In my head, I'm saying I'm not in full control of this. And there are other forces at work around me, whether it's other people, whether it's other circumstances, whether it's truly a higher power. And what that then means is, specifically this concept, Stolberg notes about self-referential thinking, which is the idea of like, I'm using myself as the source or the fulcrum. And if I don't, if I take myself out of that equation, apparently neuroscientists have identified a difference that happens internally. Self-referential thinking seems to produce more difficulty for us in terms of generating positive responses. And so when we can reduce self-referential thinking and be able to identify some of these kinds of things like I'm not in full control here, like there's other things at work and it's not just me and it's not just inside me, then I'm able to arrive at better scenarios and situations. I think that's really fascinating. Now, like I said, I wanted to dwell on that a moment. But there are some practical solutions here that help us see examples of something like that in day-to-day. What would this look like? And that can be great. But at a minimum, I see that in, I mentioned David's Psalms earlier, and just those poems essentially as a kind of archetype for this process. You know, I see that I'm broken. I see that I'm lost. I can't do it. My enemies are at my doorstep. They're about to destroy me. And I need help. And there's something here that can, something else can solve this problem. And potentially it would involve David, you know, in some of the instances here, his solutions did involve him actually solving the problem. But my point being, that's that kind of starting point for us. So we see that. All right, now let's talk about some practical suggestions. This is where we're going to try to tie everything together in just a few quick things that I think are definitely helpful and now are going to bring us to the consideration that we started with here. When I'm trying to make change or when change is happening around me, what are some things that can help? So the first one that I want to note here comes right from Stahlberg, and he says it's good to ask for and receive help. In fact, if you look at it like this, this is where we get back to this self-referential thinking. My resources are inadequate to address my circumstance. Like, I can't do it. Chaos has arrived and I cannot coerce order. So I am powerless. Well, one very simple practical thing is to ask somebody else for something that I need. Help me out here. So I find the people around me and as Stahlberg notes, the word is borrowing resources from people. And that could be just, you know, support. That could be literal, like, you have some things that can help me with this. You know, can I borrow them? Can you help me yourself? You know, that kind of thing. So whatever it may be. But this is where when we start talking about something like pursuing goals and that type of change, this is such an important step. We cannot minimize. We saw it in the early research when we were looking at some of the research around why people or how people achieve lasting resolutions, New Year's resolutions. One of the considerations was people don't necessarily have clear senses of like what it means to be accountable to these goals. And we know the principle here, if I can ask other people to help me out, I am much more likely to be successful in the thing and for many reasons. So I appreciate that as a very practical thing. Whatever the goals that we're pursuing, whatever the challenges, circumstances, or changes, look for other people that we can lean on. That's good. Number two, the next one here is, I also think from Stahlberg, a pretty helpful suggestion. And that is just to try to simplify. I think it's always good to simplify. There's a lot of unnecessary things that drive our attention and our focus, attract it and distract it. And when that's the case, how often do we just sit down and say, how much of this is unnecessary? Things I'm doing, how I'm spending my time and efforts and energies, where can I tighten it up a bit? And so that reminds me of Marty Hayer, who back when we interviewed him for the podcast some years ago, was talking about this idea that, you know, he's busy. He's working in the medical field. He's got kids. He's trying to train to be a world-class marathoner. And you just can't, you don't have any extra moments. No wasted minutes was his line. So that's the idea here. Identify the clutter and get rid of it. As you might guess, I have a strong opinion about certain media that are culprits here, that may be social media at that, and they take way more of our time than we know. And the simple test that everybody can do is you put a time limit on a certain app on your phone, because, you know, phones can do that somehow. I know it to be true. I just don't know how to do it. You can say, I only want to spend 1 hour on this app in a day, right? Find out how fast you hit that 1 hour and how many times you want to turn off that time limit and ignore it. I would suggest that you don't. If you put a time limit, don't break it, because as soon as you do, you're never going to keep it. But you can always adjust the time limit, by the way, the next day. But if you break it in the moment, it becomes a pointless boundary. Okay, now, that's the simplify. Find the stuff and declutter. Declutter your consciousness, declutter your life, in some sense. And always, when we do any kind of decluttering and simplifying, start with the highest priorities and don't declutter those as far as like the good things that are necessary for those. And then look at the lowest priorities and say, that's the chopping block right there. We can cut plenty of stuff there. Okay, now, last one that I want to share here in the moment, a few good practical solutions, is when we are considering that practice, practicing our responses. And we need to be better about that. We need to be more aware of those kinds of things. And in order to do that, we need to have time to put attention to them. So insofar as the decluttering goes, I think this is another layer of it. But, you know, many of us, myself included, we like to listen to things while we run, podcasts, perhaps this one, in fact, or audiobooks or music and all of that. Pick some time. Doesn't have to be every single day. Doesn't have to be every run, but pick some time that you don't listen to anything and you use that time to think. We have built in, as runners, we have built in meditation and prayer time. And it doesn't have to be either of those. It can just be thinking, which is the same thing. But that being the case, it's built in. It's given to us. We should use it more often, deliberately, for that reason. So use some running time. Pick a day each week. That's my thinking time. I'm going to think about the week. I'm going to anticipate the challenges this week and how am I going to respond to them. I'm going to think about my relationships in my life and where are their challenges there and how can I respond better next time that arises. And what are the things that are changing and how can I address those as well. So there you have it. That's a few key practical responses. We could just keep talking. We could go with more. But in fact, next week, we have an interview with a guest who's going to share some additional thoughts from personal experience around this topic and some more considerations for us. It's going to be wonderful. But before we get to that, we have some interesting things to share with you from the world of running.
There are a lot of exciting things to share about the world of running. First up, the USATF Cross Country Championships. This is the individual championship. You'll remember not long ago we had the team, the club championships. Now this is individual. And this was at Pole Green Park in Mechanicsville, Virginia. And on the women's side, a name that you've heard very recently, the winner, Wayne Colati. Very exciting because Colati made history by becoming the first woman to win Foot Locker, NCAA, and the USA cross country titles. So all three of those. But you'll remember that we recently shared about Colati because she, just 6 days prior to this race, set the American record in the half marathon in Houston. So a name that's definitely on your radar now. It should have been before because she's doing great things before, but she's really showing up here and it's very exciting to see. She won very dominantly in this championship. In fact, she won by the largest margin of victory since Alefine Tuilemach in 2017. So she won by 37.3 seconds. And ran a time of 32:58 on the 10K course. Second behind her was Emma Hurley and then Katie Camarena coming in third. Now on the men's side, the winner was Cooper Tier. And this is a very different kind of conversation too because he has such variety. Tier is the first man to win US titles in the 1500 meter run and cross country since John Mason in 1968. So quite a bit of range. This is how it kind of went down on the men's side. While Colati dominated on the women's side, it was a little different as far as racing goes for the men. It was taken out very strong by Olympic triathlete Morgan Pearson, and he pushed the pace in the second half of the race, and Tier was the only one to go with Pearson when he made a move at 8K. And then Tier made his own strong move at 9K and ended up winning in a time of 29:06. Second place was the 2020 champion, Anthony Rodich of the U.S. Army, and he ran 29:11.6, and then Ahmed Muhammad was third, and then Morgan Pearson hung on for fourth place. So that was the USATF cross country, and then this does determine who will represent Team USA at the World Cross Country Championships. Colati's agent did say that they are planning on her running in it, but Cooper Tier's agent said that they're not really sure what his spring will look like, so we didn't get a confirmation on that, but it sounds like Colati will be performing for us at the world stage representing Team USA. Now we're hopping on the track for some collegiate action, and it's going to sound a little bit like deja vu because I'm going to tell you about 1,000-meter collegiate record, which was broken last week, and it was broken again this week, which is a little bit crazy because the record stood for nearly 8 years by Brandon Kidder before it was broken last week by Yusuf Bizimena, and he didn't even get to enjoy it 8 days before it was broken again by Georgetown freshman Tenoda Matasada, and he ran 2 minutes 18.05 seconds Friday, and it was barely, narrowly breaking the 218.10 by Bizimena. Now, I should tell you a little bit about Matasada because he was the USATF U20 800 meter title winner, and he also swept the New Balance indoor and outdoor 800 meter crowns as a senior in high school. So he's coming in and very fast and furious, I would say, especially breaking a collegiate record as a freshman. So exciting times with a lot of great middle distance running coming up through college runners. So these are things to pay attention to. We might even see them at the trials. Who knows? These are the type of runners that are blossoming and you don't really know what they can do. So these are really exciting times. In other collegiate news, which is also not just collegiate news, but American running news, Nico Young ran the fastest ever at 7,000 feet of elevation in Flagstaff. He ran the first sub-4 performance at 7,000 feet in a time of 3:57.33. This was at the Lumberjack Team Challenge, where last year he ran a time of 4:02. Not last year, in 2022, at the same meet, he ran 4:02.89. So he improved by a significant margin with this performance, which is impressive. So let me put it a little bit in perspective for you. So Young's career best indoor is 3:56. So this is 3:57. Okay. Now a second in this distance, in the distance of a mile, is, you know, it's a lot, but like for 7,000 feet of elevation, that's not a lot. These are not equal times, not by a long shot. And I do want to give you perspective with other American greats like Ryan Hill, Will Lear, Corey Leslie, and Craig Miller. They've also achieved sub-4 running at elevation, but it was in Albuquerque, which is not quite as high of elevation at 5,300 feet. And none of them ran faster than Nico Young did with a 3:57. So they weren't even running as high of elevation and still didn't run as fast as Nico Young. One that has, though, is Edward Tesserek, representing Kenya. He ran a time of 3:54.73 indoors in 2018, but that, again, was in Albuquerque, so it wasn't quite as high of elevation. This is really exciting, and I don't know what it means exactly. I think elevation is something that there's conversions for and things of that nature, but you never can put full stock in what those conversions would be. But it does say that he might be able to run a 3:48.71 mile at sea level. So we shall see. That is ridiculously fast. So this is very exciting for Nico Young. And as we continue to update you on his career moving forward, this is great for American distance running. And we are excited to bring more to you as his career unfolds. Again, that was 3:57 at 7,000 feet of elevation.
Well, we hope that we have given you plenty of things to think about as we've addressed this series on change, and certainly as we've shared a number of things that have been happening recently, we've got a lot more coming in terms of the world of running and some of the interesting things around that, not least of which the U.S. Olympic Marathon team trials are coming up soon. We're going to share some thoughts about that with you after the fact, and including personal experiences. So you may be interested to hear some of the kind of the report from the Olympic trials. How did that go this year in the United States? We're going to be sharing some of those thoughts and more coming soon. But remember that if you want to get your questions in, you got to send an email to questions@A2Z running.com. You can also just go to the website, A2Z running.com/questions. But it's usually easier to just send a direct email. questions@a2zrunning.com. Anything about running, training, and how these things intersect with your life, we're glad to share some thoughts, share some responses. Until then, thank you for listening, and we'll talk to you next week.